We're talking about civil righteousness, where a man strives to be upright and decent according to the Ten Commandments. And I used the Fourth Commandment as an illustration. Now, don't let anybody have the idea that God ignores what the unbeliever does along the lines of civil righteousness, because it isn't fair to God. And he wouldn't have that. He won't have that. Yes, sir. Sure, I was leading up to that, but this is what I want you to get under your collar. You only start with one thing. And this is the thing that would bother you more than what follows. Because just to throw this at you like that would be stunning, you know. God rewards civil righteousness, even if I add with temporal blessings, you might even be willing to demur a little bit. And that stands. You cannot gainsay that. Then we go on to say, but they're nevertheless sins. Because anything that is done outside of faith is sin. But that does not alter the fact that God has bound himself by his own promises. And if he would renege, he wouldn't be God. You tell people, don't you ever figure that God will back out on his promises. He's not that much of a heel. When he says, I'll do it, he'll do it. And he does it. Yes, sir. We can go as far as God will go. I don't see where we'd be risking anything if we can go as far as God will go. And if God will recognize works of civil righteousness, there's no reason why we shouldn't.
Yeah, but this is more of a general rule than it is the kind of thing you can... I mean, you just can't tell somebody if you obey the Ten Commandments, everything will be rosy in your life.
No, we wouldn't say.
Were they worse than anybody else? No.
You wouldn't even say to a person, now you become a Christian and you'll have a rosy life.
Yeah.
Don't you ever do that. That's not for us to say. And we didn't say that. All that we said, and that much you can say anytime, anywhere. God rewards civil righteousness with temporal blessings. And it's that proposition that some are not willing to make because they don't know better. So that's why I gave you that cross-reference. And you may need it someday, because I wouldn't be surprised if somebody would throw up his hand if you'd make a statement like that. Then you can back it up with this reference. And it's downright true. There's no mistake about it. Well, anyway, this is in this part which says there is no disagreement among our theologians with regard to these and these points. Then don't overlook in this section, gentlemen. Of course, you may be familiar with Luther's preface to St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans. But if you're not, this excerpt that you have here is a gem. Section 9 reads, hence, faith alone is the mother and source of the truly good and God-pleasing works that God will reward both in this and in the next, both in this and in the next world. For this reason, St. Paul calls them fruits of faith or of the Spirit. Now, for as Luther writes in his preface to the Epistle of St. Paul to the Romans, faith is a divine work in us that transforms us and begets us anew from God, kills the old Adam, makes us entirely different people in heart, spirit, mind, and all our powers, and brings the Holy Spirit with it. Now comes this exuberant reflection. Oh, faith is a living, busy, active, mighty thing, so that it is impossible for it not to be constantly doing what is good. Likewise, faith does not ask if good works are to be done, but before one can ask, faith has already done them and is constantly active. Whoever does not perform such good works is a faithless man, blindly tapping around in search of faith and good works without knowing what either faith or good works are. And in the meantime, he chatters and jabbers a great deal about faith and good works and so on. That's a classic. One of the finest things that Luther ever penned, just that introduction to the Epistle to the Romans. Now, section 13. But since on these points there has been no controversy among us, we shall discuss them no further, but shall explain only the controverted points simply and clearly. And now comes in the first place. See, so all of this, including the introduction, has led up to the real nitty-gritty of this particular controversy. And so then, in the first place, it is evident that in this discussing the question whether good works are necessary or free, that's the first angle of this thing. I see that I'm going to have time only to point up these parts, and I may have to follow through a little bit in the next period on some of the others. Next page, secondly, in other words, this is section 21. When we teach that good works are necessary, we must also explain why and for what causes they are necessary. That's the next thing, that as the Augsburg Confession and the Apology have done. Down at the bottom of the page, you have reference to Article 6 and Article 20 and the Apology, Article 4. I perhaps will come back to Article 6. I won't have time today, but I'll perhaps come back to Article 6 of the Augsburg Confession before we go on in the next period. And then at the bottom of page 555, in the third place, a disputation has arisen as to whether good works preserve salvation or are necessary to preserve faith, righteousness, and salvation. In other words, whether good works are sort of a preservative which will give us a sort of a guarantee that we're really going to make it, that we're really going to go to heaven. That question is answered. And then on the next page, in section 31, here I have a cross-reference that I want to give you in the paragraph that reads, "Therefore, we must begin by earnestly criticizing and rejecting the false Epicurean delusion which some dream up that it is impossible to lose faith and the gift of righteousness and salvation once it has been received through any sin, even a wanton, deliberate one, or through wicked works, and that even though a Christian follows in his evil lusts without fear and shame, resists the Holy Spirit, and deliberately proceeds to sin against his conscience, he can nevertheless retain faith, the grace of God, righteousness, and salvation." That notion is knocked into a cocked hat. And there you make a reference to page 126 on this statement that I just read, page 126, section 143, or in the Triglotta, go to page 161. Page 161, and in the last half of the last paragraph in that column on page 161. The section references are not identical, but you read the last half of that last paragraph on page 161, and you have substantially a parallel to this passage here in Article 4 of the Formula of Concord. And then in the next paragraph on this, going back to the Article 4, section 33, the Apology offers a fine example as to when and how, on the basis of the preceding, the exhortation to do good works can be instilled without darkening the doctrine of faith and justification. On that point, make a reference to page 228, section 12, or in the Triglutta, page 341, in the second column. Triglutta, Tappert, page 228, section 12. And that is to match section 33 on page 556. And then now, quickly, I have one more cross-reference that I'll give you. Then you'll have the whole article before you. On page 557 in section 37, in the fourth place, concerning the proposition that good works are supposed to be detrimental to salvation. That was another of those notions that were current at that time. Now, in that paragraph, down about the middle, or a little below the middle, for when good works are done on account of right causes and for right ends, that is, with the intention that God demands of the regenerated, they are an indication of salvation in believers. That point, there referred to page 148, section 275. Page 148, section 275. And in the Triglutta, refer to page 199. Page 199. The first column, about 26 lines from the bottom of the page. So the sentence starts with, "And yet Christ." And yet Christ. And there you have a parallel to this passage that I have just referred to here. Now, with that, I'm going to leave you for the time being with Article 4. You can get into it, and I may have some few things to add when I meet you tomorrow.